Hello everyone, it's Shahid here from The Creative Floor. Welcome to our fifth podcast. Please do rate us on iTunes and subscribe if you enjoy listening to this. We have an amazing guest today. I couldn't be more excited, actually. We are joined by Tom Richards, who is Chief Creative Officer of Havas Links Group. Hey, Tom.
Hello. How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Not so bad, thanks. Bit busy, bit tired, but yeah, I'm good.
Standard role of a creative director, I guess, right?
There's too many opportunities going to waste time.
Yeah, no, it's cool. So thank you so much for joining us. I mean, I hope you don't mind me saying this, but I think you've sort of run the northern powerhouse of the United Kingdom. And, you know, last year, I think you took Havas Links to probably the highest heights the agency has ever been, where you won, you know, Cannes Lions Agency of the Year. But I think before we kind of talk about that and sort of, you know, talk about how you did it and all those sorts of things, I think it would just be really, really fascinating, as I think a lot of these podcasts have been, is just trying to talk to people in terms of how they got started and how it all began for them. So is that okay if we take that flow with you today?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, cool. So in the beginning, what happens? What happened to you?
I was an only child brought up on a farm, so very shy, a million miles away from the person I've seen to have become today.
Where was the farm?
It was in the base of the Brecon Beacons, in a little village called Senny Bridge.
Oh, wow.
But cool. Yeah, so it was, you know, going back in the day, so I was probably a little bit lazy, but my parents were obviously wondering whether I was going to be taking over the family farm or not. But I think because I'd spent hours and hours drawing pictures of Garfield, they realized that I could draw a little bit, I was good at copying. So when it came to sort of going off to college, I had the choice of going to art college or agricultural college.
So, what a choice.
Yeah. It's like either stay in the valleys or go to the bright lights of the city. So obviously I chose the bright lights of the city.
And where was the city? Was that Cardiff or?
No, it was Carmarthen, first of all. So it wasn't even a city really. So I did a foundation course there, first of all. And that got me to try different angles of being a creative, graphics, interior design, fashion, sculpture. Actually, I really loved fashion. I nearly kind of went that way, which would have been even more surprising for a farmer's son.
But you're quite well dressed, actually, to be fair. Well, I must say, all the photos that I've seen, so that all kind of connects.
Well dressed for a farmer, is that what you're saying?
No, just really well dressed. Like, you know, I mean, I always look like a mess, so I sort of do notice when people dress well. So yeah, I know where that comes from now.
Well, I try. I've got my daughter's obviously my fashion advisor, my stylist now.
Right, cool.
She doesn't let me out of the house sometimes. Dad, you dressed like a teenager. You're not going out looking like that.
Nice. Sorry, so you're at college.
So, well, I went to, this is going to be more random. So I went off and I did a HND in Doncaster. I'd taken a year out of college, and I had become an amateur jockey. And it was obviously my mum used to breed horses.
So, oh, wow.
So I worked in a racing yard for half of my gap year.
You're quite tall for a jockey, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're taller than me.
It was national hunting point to point, so I had to do a lot of dieting. I think I went...
Oh, right. God.
I rode... The lightest I ever rode at was 10 stone 2.
Oh, my God.
And that was including all my kits, all my saddle and my jumpers.
Wow.
And I was 13 stone probably about 2 weeks before that, so I had a bit of crap dieting.
Wow. Okay, so you're a jockey. Then how did you become? How did you get moved from that?
Yeah, you know. So, I decided to go to Doncaster to do a HND. It was a really good advertising course, but it also had a race course there. So back in the day, that was a train of thought. Yeah, I was going to race course, and that'd be really cool. But obviously, I never went racing again because I found beer and girls and
and horses.
Different type of thing.
Yeah.
And a really good mate of mine, Gareth Howells, had just just finished at Manchester Uni, and he said, he goes, look, Tom, let's team up and become a young creative team and see if we can get a job. So I was like, right, Gareth, that sounds cool. So we sort of teamed up, and I said, for some reason, I'm obviously an art director, but for some reason I said I'd be the writer because I was slightly less dyslexic than he was.
Right.
So it was just, it was a funny old team. So we basically thought visually rather than wrote headlines.
Mm.
But we spent, I think it was probably just a knock on from being a student. We spent too much time sitting around watching daytime TV and not really doing any work like we were supposed to.
Yeah.
And we were flicking, surfing channels, and This Morning came on, and there was my then girlfriend, who Becky, who's now my wife, and she was being interviewed, I think, by Anne and Nick.
Wow.
About this new catalogue she'd just launched in her first job. And so Gareth and I just looked at each other and went, mate, like, we're going to have to do something about this. What's wrong with it? So we decided that was it. We had to make a proper effort to get the first job. And so we started going on a few placements and meeting a few people. And we met a guy called Simon Sinclair, who advised us that there was this new agency in Manchester that had just been started by a guy called Andy Cheatham.
Right.
And he was just from JWT, but it was Andy Cheatham and Dave Bell. So, but he also said, he goes, right, this guy, he's first 15 captain of Didsbury Toc H rugby.
Yeah.
So Gareth and I went, right, this is brilliant, because we'd both been to a really good rugby school called Llandovery College.
Yeah.
So we then thought, right, let's see what we can do. So what we did is we went training, and three training sessions in, and I still remember it to the day, it was a really muddy night. And we just found ourselves, we clocked Andy, we knew who he was, and Andy walked into the shower before us, and then we followed him in.
Just getting more interesting, yeah.
We actually just really awkwardly introduced ourselves to him. Hi, Andy, you're Andy Cheatham, we're two students, we'd love a job.
You didn't drop any soap, did you?
Well, that's the X-rated version of the story.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, so literally, that's how I've got my foot and everything else into the door.
Wow. What? And just from that, he said, yeah, come in and see me.
Yeah, come in. So we came in, and then we literally started our placement that week. And we were there for nearly a year before he gave us a job. Yeah, he made us work for it. He really made.
And how old are you back then?
I'd be 22.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so the company hadn't grown that big, but there was an opportunity to take on one art director.
Right.
And then we'd also heard BDH were looking for an art director as well. So I went for the interview there with Gareth, and we sort of tossed a coin. So we said, right, Gareth, you go to Cheatham Bell, I'll go to BDH. So we thought, right, that's brilliant. We're sorted.
Oh, wow.
Got our first proper jobs. Obviously, BDH then became TBWA later on.
Right.
But I phoned up BDH the following week on the Friday to say, right, what time do you want me to come in? Where do you want me? And the creative director went, oh, no, Tom, I'm really sorry. We should have called you, but we've taken on somebody else from internally. There's no longer a job.
Oh, no.
So I was like, mate, that's just no. Because obviously Gareth and I had been working together, and then we'd literally split. So it left me completely on my own.
Yeah.
And Gareth had taken the job. So, I just went to Andy. I called Andy up and went, Andy, mate, look, this has happened. And he goes, right, Tom, I'll tell you what. He goes, this big white cream box, this Apple Mac thing has just come out. If you can learn how to use this, you've got a job. I was like, right, I'll do it. I'll do anything. I've obviously done the bit in the shower. So, yeah. Andy knew. So that's where I started. I started basically on their Mac, doing loads of typesetting and becoming their typographer. But it was obviously back in the day. There was I think Tony Vees was kicking around, Steve Daniels, Andy Cheatham, Dave Bell. So I had some really great creatives, and they'd just do a scamp and then hand me the scamp.
Mm.
And then it was up for me to sort of do the art direction.
Right.
And that's a bit what I mentioned before, but I got bored of using the Mac, so I'd start coming up with ideas for typography and typefaces.
Yeah.
And so I was basically sort of applying art direction as I went. So for me, it was a really great grounding. I think particularly now that I'm obviously at the other end of the tree, obviously I became the art director and creative director, etc. I now have complete understanding and empathy for the guys who you know, are at the coalface, you know, the Apple, you know, the Mac operators and the art workers.
Yeah.
So it's good to have a full-on understanding.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Okay, so then what happens?
So, back as I said, you know, dead chuff, got my first piece of work into DNAD for Roy Castle from not using a Mac. But unfortunately, I'd also become very good at using the Mac, and I was running the studio and had a couple of people underneath me, and I was starting to develop rate cards for how much we were charging, and I was going, right, this is not who I was supposed to be. I'm supposed to be an art director.
Mm.
And unfortunately, because I was good at what I was doing, it was never going to happen at Cheat and Bell. So I had to go, right, it's time to time to move on. So I started looking around, and obviously Gareth, my friend who I mentioned earlier, he'd been on a placement working with Dougal Wilson at Folds.
Oh, amazing. What, the director?
Yeah. So yeah. Dougal was his copywriter.
Oh, wow.
And then Gareth was his art director. So they told me to come up to Scotland. So I went up and met them, and they basically introduced me to Jim Downey, who was the creative director of Folds.
Yeah.
And it just happened that day, a guy called Alan McCouche, he works for Mother now. So he literally left that day, and I got introduced to Jim Downey. He went, oh, mate, we're looking for an art director. So I went and replaced Al and joined Folds and was there for 7 years. So that was when I literally went, right, I'm no longer typographer, Mac operator, designer, cut, I'm now an art director.
Yeah.
So that was good, but I was under Billy Mwinney was my creative director there. So Jim Downey, first of all, and then Billy Mwinney. So I had a good couple of guys up there. But I suppose what was interesting there, I obviously got to work on lots of really interesting work.
Yeah.
But I realized after the first year, I was looking at my portfolio, and I realized all my work was looking the same.
Right.
I thought, this is just, yeah, I'm using the same sort of fonts, and I'm just reshuffling things around on the Mac.
And how big was the agent? How big was the agency?
I would have been about 140 people.
Okay, so it's pretty decent.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, 140 people. So it was a full service. So we had our own media department. It was really good. Lots of really good work on. The biggest campaign I worked on was Auto Trader. It was a Find Your Perfect Partner campaign.
Oh, yeah.
So that was good. That was about, the accounts we used to have up there, that would have been a £12 million account. We had Royal Bank of Scotland, Standard Life, Quick Fit, some really, really big sort of mainstream.
Yeah, big UK brands, yeah.
Yeah, really good stuff.
Yeah.
But it's quite interesting now that I do work in health, when I look back at all my favourite pieces of work that I'm most proud of, and probably the ones that have done the best in awards, are actually, we're all health.
Mm.
It was like the Roy Castle or Scottish Blood Transfusion. It's quite amazing when you look back that obviously the pattern was kind of forming that I would end up in health at some time.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so then what happens after Folds?
Jim Folds, the guy who owned it, sold it, and he sold it to the guy who took it over and then basically just ruined it within 18 months, and we just lost all our accounts.
What happened?
Well, I can't say too much because...
they'll come and kill you.
The guy who owned it wasn't a nice guy, wasn't very charismatic.
Okay.
Lost the trust of clients and the agency. And like I said, and it was also a time when a devolution sort of kicked in for the first time around. So a lot of English brands headed south.
So
it went from 140 to 90 to 60 to 45 to about 25 of us before it folded.
Oh my God.
Folded. So that was me. Yeah, so I just had my first child. So it was a bit of a scary time, sort of straight out.
So how old are you now? About 30, something like that?
Yeah, about 30, yeah. What's that phrase? It's really good. I'm a millennial with 20 years experience.
I like that. That's good. To get a T-shirt. Yeah.
Yeah, so I freelanced then for a little bit. So I went down to McCann's. So freelance in McCann's.
So is that Manchester, yeah?
Yeah, Manchester. So that was good. I was there for a few months. And then I ended up back at Cheetham Bell JWT, because obviously Cheetham Bell had sold out or merged with JWT. So I then I went back there and I was freelance there for a while, did some nice work, and then the job came up again. So joined there as a group head, working with a guy called Pete Armstrong. And we did some great work. Probably did some work for a workwear brand that you wouldn't get away with doing that style of work now. It was a bit.
What was it?
It was called. It was for a company called Scruffs.
What do they do?
They do workwear. So
workwear. Okay.
Yeah, they were it was all like padded knees and tool belts and stuff like that. So, but they also they wanted to make a lot of noise. So we. We went quite edgy. We did a spoof porn film for them. Yeah, which obviously went down very well with the audience, and sales went through the roof. So that was really good. And it did very well at Cannes, won a couple of Lions and got a lot of finals.
Oh, that's great. Is there anywhere that people can go and see that?
Yeah, it's online somewhere. You type in Scruffs workwear, it's going to get dirty. Yeah. I could probably put that down as a mistake now, because you know the way the world today, it wouldn't be right. And I think if one of my creatives came up to me and showed me that as a script, I'd probably say, "Yeah, guys, it's not really appropriate to today." But back then, it was sort of okay.
Yeah. No. I mean, times have moved on, I guess, a little bit in terms of taste and PC and all that sort of stuff. Out of interest, I mean, how conscious were you being up north doing what you were doing versus where, you know, all the sort of sexy agencies, I guess, were kind of down south? I mean, undoubtedly, you know, Chet and Bell and McCann, Manchester have fantastic reputations. I mean, was there a need to prove yourself constantly on every piece of work, or how did you actually, how did the community up there feel about all the sort of the big brands being down south, doing all, having all the huge budgets and all those sorts of things?
You know what? There's a lot. I think it helps the character of the northern or the creative who's outside of London.
Yeah,
it kind of, you know, it's a bit like the Manchester spirit. We're a bit chippy. You know, we're like, come on, we'll have a go.
Yeah,
and we love it when, you know, our work starts appearing in the big awards. People like, where were these guys?
It's yeah,
like, you know, we do is good work. And we probably work, you know, we have to think a bit cleverer because our budgets aren't as good.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we get a few favours and, yeah. But saying, I mean, Manchester's always had a good creative reputation. Scotland as well. I mean, back when I was up there, it was, you know, Folds would regularly get work in D&AD, the Leith would too, and the Union, Frame, you know, they're always there on the awards circuit. And even I remember coming down from when I worked at Scotland, you'd come down and you'd basically win all the awards at the Roses and then jump back on the plane and go back again. It's good to have something to rally against, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so then what happens? You'd make your porn film, you win some Lions. Then what happens?
So then I was full time then at Cheetham Bell, but obviously I've been there for 18 months. And you know, it was kind of one of those ones. I think somebody advised me once: you should never go back. You always keep going forward, and kind of felt a little bit like that. And there was obviously Andy was the head of the tree there, and there was no room for sort of growth. So it was time to sort of to see what else was around. And then I got approached by TBWA, so I went and joined there. I was there with a guy called Doug for a while.
What year was that then? What year was that?
Oh, that would be 2000 now. Yeah, just after 2002 maybe. Yeah.
Okay, and so how does that actually work? Because, I mean, was Trevor Beattie running TBWA down in London at that time?
Or? No, he'd been off and set up BNB by then.
Okay.
So what happened was, so obviously it was TBWA Manchester. So I think Danny Brooke Taylor had been the creative director there.
Oh, yeah.
And then obviously I think when Trevor Beattie left and Danny went down and he became a creative director, didn't he?
TBWA.
So, yeah, and then there was TBWA had got rid of the BDH name. And then, it was a funny old place. And I stayed there for 18 months and it was okay. Did some nice work for GHD, worked with Rankin and stuff. So,
yeah.
getting nice work for Wix. So yeah, there were some great accounts to work on. And again, you know, still getting a show in the international awards, which is obviously good for your reputation. So then obviously things go sort of full circle. Then Billy Winnie, who was my creative director up at Folds, he joined BJL. He joined BJL. He then called me on his first day and went, "Tom, I want you to come and be my deputy creative director."
Yeah.
So we obviously then I started working with a guy called Pete Basterman, who's down at BCCP. So now we then went and became the deputies at BJL. Obviously, BJL, really good independent agency.
Yeah.
And I think obviously there was the whole point of going there. There was a progression. So the plan was obviously to become the creative directors, and that happened really quickly, actually. So after 6 months, we became co-creative directors of BJL.
Oh, cool.
And then had a really good, I think it was about 7 years. So, yeah, love working there. It was had lots of great opportunities, lots of great work for likes of Ron Seal and Crown Paints, Subaru as well. Subaru was a big sort of passion of mine. Obviously, that was really, really interesting. Obviously, going all the way back to me being a farm boy. In fact, my first car was a Subaru.
Oh, right.
Legacy. And it was quite obviously given to me by my stepfather. It was quite an interesting story, which I told when we pitched for the business, first of all, that obviously being a farm boy, my estate car doubled up as something else. I'd be driving around with my girlfriend.
Yeah, that won the pitch.
Yeah, it was like a legacy in a Subaru Legacy.
Yeah, whatever works, I guess. Yeah.
But again, I think even back to obviously being at BJL, it was a big passion to take on other agencies and be super competitive. And I think in the sort of my co 10 years as a creative director with Pete, and then for the 3 years I did it on my own, I think we took BJL to be the most awarded agency outside of London. At the Rose.
Oh, really? Wow.
Four times. So.
And how big was BJL then back then?
Oh, it was between 40 and 55 people. I'd
okay,
think.
It's quite decent then. It's quite a decent size, isn't it?
Yeah, a tiny class. Good agency.
And so at this moment in time, I guess that you've been doing this for quite a while, right? You've had quite a lot of exposure at different agencies. You've worked for a lot of some really fantastic creative directors and some great brands. What was your learnings in terms of becoming, a creative director at BJL and, doing it for quite a while and having a huge amount of success at awards and building a reputation? What were your key learnings, I suppose is what I'm trying to ask you, in terms of moving from being an art director over to a creative director?
Yeah, oh God, there's so many, isn't there? I mean, tell one little story. I mean, this is put me in good stead over the years, where I was, I think I was working on the Royal Bank of Scotland, and got a really nice sort of idea, big press campaign that ran in the Financial Times. Really, really, really super idea. And I'd been working on the art direction.
What was the idea?
Oh, I can't remember it now.
I was imagining it was great. Okay.
It was basically taking on the FTSE companies, and just it was like a tactical campaign that was obviously telling the FTSE companies that their success was due to RBS.
Okay.
But obviously, looking back at it now.
Yeah. In hindsight, yeah.
Well, the brief wasn't me, honestly. I didn't ruin the RBS.
Yeah. It's your fault.
Yes, I'm really bad creative.
Yeah. Sorry.
I'd got the idea, and then it was coming down to the art direction and layouts, and I did a couple of layouts, and I took them into my creative director and went, right, here we are, what do you think? And I was, a junior excited art director, and I'd worked so hard. And he went, oh, I'm not sure. I went, all right. And he goes, well, you should try this. And he was very traditional, and he wanted initial caps and da-da-da-da, and Bodoni as a typeface. I was like, right, okay. So I went away, and I spent another 2 days working on it, and I went in and I absolutely nailed it, and I was so chuffed. I went, here we are, Billy, what do you reckon of this? And he just went, nope, hate it. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
And he gave me a real hard time. And I was like, right. Then I went away. Really disappointed. I spent the whole weekend like being sort of quite upset about it. And right, that's not good. This, but I dug deep and I thought I'm not being beaten. So I went again. And but this time I went, right, he asked me to do a Bodoni typeface, an initial capture. I'm just going to do that. So I did exactly what he wanted, exactly.
Yeah.
And then I did my other two versions, and I thought, well, mine are way better than his. And I went, well, how am I going to play this? So I was really quite nervous. So I went in on the Monday morning and went, right, Billy, I've done what you asked. This is what you wanted. And he looked at me, oh, brilliant. Thanks, Tom. Thanks. And then I've done these two. And he went, yours are way better than mine. Well done, yeah. Keep going. And then, I just walked out and thought, right, that's how you play people. You do exactly what they ask, and then you do what you believe in. So from then on, that's what I've done, and that's what I've, even as a creative director, the first part of the job is listening to clients, asking what they want, pushing them in the right direction. And then when you go and present, you go, right, this is what you wanted.
Yeah.
This is what we think is best.
Yeah.
And then more often than not, they go with the better way because, you brought in a bit of psychology for the reason. For the one they like is, it's familiar. You show a lot of other pieces of work the same, and then you obviously get them buying into your vision.
Yeah. And I think they probably appreciate the thought process because they just want to feel reassured that they've been listened to, and then you've just obviously done it. But then I think they do appreciate the thought process in terms of how you move on from the initial idea that they wanted you to do into something better, because that's the benefit of time and working with great people, right? They kind of will always take a great idea and make it even better, or even just an average idea and make it way, way better.
It's just adding a bit of polish. But no, you're totally right. It is the listening. And if the ideal way of working is you have a meeting, or we call them a huddle. We have a huddle with the client. So you get a creative director, you get a account person, a strategist, and obviously if you can bring in a medic too, and the client, you all sit in a room.
Yeah.
And you have a workshop to talk about, what's good about the sector, what's bad, show a load of work and go, look at the familiarities. You've got a happy, smiley patient on a beach with a dog.
Yeah.
If the patient is walking a pig,
then
you're going to stand out.
Yeah.
I've got no idea what that means, but you know what I'm
saying. I'm writing that down because that's a good idea. I don't know what for, but that's cool. So now we're at BJL. You've been there for 7 years. What would you say is sort of your most, proudest creative moment so far to date?
Winning agencies of the year at the Roses. Those are pretty good. Pretty proud moments.
Yeah.
Obviously, look at it. But also another really proud one was obviously winning Ronseal. That was really good because we'd obviously been working on the account, and they'd asked us to sort of bring back, obviously the line does exactly what it says on the tin.
Okay.
And we were struggling for ages to try and work out how to bring that to life in a new way. But obviously, creators being creators, everybody was trying to change the line. But obviously, the point was don't change it because it's out there in language. People use it every day. So we managed to just sort of bring a bit of a new strategy in, and that was all about honesty and basically just realizing that DIY is actually shit. Nobody loves it.
Yeah.
People hate it.
Yeah.
Because they hate it, they need to get it over and done with really quickly.
Yeah.
And then that was the sort of the new strategy for Ronseal, because it does exactly what it says on the tin, because you don't want to be hanging around wasting your time when you can be in the pub having a beer.
So that
was really good actually to bring that one in and bring it into BJL.
And when you're pitching, are you pitching against other agencies up north, or are you pitching against agencies from London and elsewhere?
Back in the consumer world, we'd be pitching against everybody.
Oh, that's great. North
agencies, London agencies, and I think obviously even back 6 years ago, you could see how advertising sort of budgets were starting to struggle in London, and you'd suddenly see a BBH or a TBWA on pitching against you for like a small part of Warburton's.
Oh right, wow!
And you go, right, what's happening here?
Yeah,
before they wouldn't be going for accounts like that. And it's quite interesting, you know, and obviously now today, obviously advertising is changing completely, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. So then what happened? So you're at BJL, you've been there for 7 years. Then what happens after that?
So, yeah, I mean, I don't know whether it was a 7 year itch or what, but I was at a networking event called the Stodge Podge.
Stodge Podge, that's cool.
It's in Harvey Nicks, so it's a pretty cool place. So, and the deal with this networking do is you sit for one course of the meal with the people on your table, and then the second course you change.
Right.
Change seats. So I got up and left and sat down next to this sort of guy with dark hair, and looked at his name badge, and it said Havas David Hunt, Havas Links.
Yeah.
And then he looked at mine, and it said Tom Richards, BJL. I was like, right, who are they? So I thought to myself. So I went, right, so Havas who? Who are you?
So you, you'd never heard of Havas Links before?
No, I think I had in a way, but I was probably taking a mick of it. But because they were obviously from, you know, Creative Links, they were from a design background.
Yeah.
And I'd always worked in advertising, obviously, you know. Design, you know, advertising designers don't like to hang around together. So yeah. I was like, Dave, Havas who? And he was like, he was Havas Links. So then he went like, BJ, Mickey back at me. And then we didn't talk, so we then both looked at our phones and went, well, yeah, we've got nothing in common here. And then obviously, yeah, and then we started to chat, and Dave said, right, what's going on with you at BJL? Oh, no, we're quite an interesting thing I've just done with my creative department. Rather than having creative teams sat together all the time, I've created three banks of creative desks. Mm. So I basically mixed up the disciplines. So we have digital people and designers and art directors and copywriters all sat on one table together.
Right.
And we have three of these. And he goes, that's an interesting model. He goes, I've just done the same with Havas Links, because Havas Links had grown to 150 people. And it was starting to lose its own identity. So what they'd just done is decided to take it back to the start when it was a small agency. So they split it into small chunks.
Right.
So then split it into, you know, five or six small boutique agencies under the one Havas Links umbrella. So we got chatting, and yeah, Dave took me out for meals for 6 months, and a bit of courting.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it sounded like it started off from a speed dating type of environment anyway. So.
Yeah, it was speed dating, but then it needed to sort of, yeah, we took it a lot slower afterwards. I played hard to get.
Yeah, old school. Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
But what was really great when I did join, obviously, because Havas Links was from a design background, and obviously very, you know, digital. That was their specialism, and, you know, obviously they were the best at health at it. They'd obviously spotted an opportunity that they should be going more after agency of record work. So obviously that's where David obviously clocked me and where I could fit in. So and then what was really good. I was kind of a bit like a championship manager where the team has just gone up to the premiership.
Yeah.
And I mean that as in I'd been given like a checkbook to go and hire people.
So did they not have a creative director at that point?
Yeah. They had two creative directors.
Okay.
They had a chief creative officer.
Okay.
So I mean, like I said, what was interesting, so it was like, I was just so lucky to just join this team, this business that was doing so well. And, you know, my role was to bring in some different kind of creatives to bolster the already strong creative department.
And interestingly, because, you know, I can recall my sort of first interaction with health and, you know, remembering why, because it was all a bit weird for me. And I just wanted to sort of maybe pick your brains a little bit, because, you know, you've just had an entire career of working on, you know, the UK's biggest brands, you know, like Subaru and Ron Seal and QuickFit and all those sorts of things. Next thing you know, you're speaking to a chap called David who's showing you all this pharma stuff. It's digital and all those sorts of things. But what did you think? I mean, were you like, what's going on? Is, you know, what was going on in your head at that point?
I think it's one of those ones. I mean, like I said, I've been like 7 years in a job, and I was probably starting to think, you know, what's the next opportunity? And maybe Dave's just, I mean, Dave is a very good salesman.
Okay. Very good salesman. So what did he say? Actually, what did he say then? What did he say? What was the final thing to clinch you?
It was funny. We basically went out for like 3 or 4 meals, and he kept asking my opinion on great creatives in the Northwest and how he should structure his team. So by this time, I actually knew what he was angling for, but I pretended that I didn't.
Right.
And then we were sat in Carluccio's, and he just sort of banged the table and went, right, Tom, let's stop fucking around. I was like, right. So it was direct, but obviously he had been showing me all the great work they were doing, and you know there was some digital apps they were working all about Beyond the Pill for sort of schizophrenia. I can remember it. So it was all about, it's called 24/7. So it was about trying to get patients off their medicine by using technology. And I was just thinking, why there's so many opportunities, and then obviously. Yeah, and then the more I thought about it, it's like, right, there's only so many whiskey ads and beer ads you can do, and, you know, maybe there's an opportunity to start doing some work that actually does some good in the world and helps people.
Yeah. And so what year is this now? Where are we?
4 years ago. I'm literally 4 years into
having sex. Okay, it's about 2015, right?
Yeah, 2015, right? Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Well, it was 6 months of
courting.
Yeah.
And then you sealed the deal.
Yeah, sealed the deal. I joined, but again, it was, you know, just a great, you know, it's a great company, and the way Havas Links does culture is just second to none. There's there's what's really interesting, like a lot of agencies, every single person has to have an ROI against them. You know, they have to do the timesheets and be earning money, but obviously, we have a team of people, probably up to about 30 people now, who just look after the health and well-being of staff and education and R&D.
What do you mean? What do they do? What do you mean?
We have like a 3-month series of academies. We do coaching, and we have like every single member of staff has to go through at least 4 of them.
Okay.
So, you know, they might be craft, they might be fundamentals, they might be, you know, we might bring in, for example, we had Lewis Hamilton's brother came in.
Oh, really?
Talked about
his younger brother.
Yeah, his younger brother.
He's in a wheelchair, isn't he? Is that right?
Yeah. So he talked about his disease and how he sort of just gets on with it, and he actually drives as well.
He's a racer, isn't he?
And then we had a stuntman last year. That was pretty good. So we had 30 people outside watching a guy telling us how he deals with his fear as he sets himself on fire.
Oh my God, how does he deal with his fear?
Well, he just sort of takes it within a deep breath, imagine himself in a different place, obviously somewhere wet where
he's yeah, he's underwater while he's on fire. Yeah.
I'm not gonna burn.
That's really cool. And I think you had Mark Denton come up and give a speech, yeah, right? Yeah.
I mean, that's another thing we do. So we have a creative AGM every year. So last year, Mark Denton came up, and which was again an absolute legend. You know, he just stood on stage and just had a couple of slides and talked about all the great work he's done over the years. And again, last year was all about dealing with your fears. And then we basically put a survey around the agency, and we had sort of three themes came about. One was the fear of presenting. Fear of the blank page, and the third one was the fear of time, and obviously never having enough time managing. So what we did, we brought in 3 specialists and we created 3 workshops.
Right.
So every one of my creatives went through these. So again, they were, you know, giving tips and tricks to help deal with their fears. So for example, the public speaking one, we've got Mark Denton to do a joke writing workshop.
Oh, cool.
And the whole day was in the comedy club.
Oh, brilliant. So
every member of the creative department had to stand on stage at the end and tell a joke.
That's terrifying, isn't it?
It was terrifying, but they all loved it there. They all came off the stage absolutely buzzing.
That's really good. I mean, obviously, I think that there's a lot of emphasis around culture that have asked links online, you know, on LinkedIn and on your website, and even what you've just spoken about, it just sounds like a really fantastic place to work. I just want to go back a little bit, because I just think the journey of you know, having that sort of courtship with David for 6 months, and then you've sort of walked into Havas Links. I think you said you were about 150 people at the time. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And I think the last time I spoke to you, I think you said you were about 350, 400 people now. Is that correct? Yeah. Is that now correct?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's phenomenal. I mean, that is just incredible. I mean, even just sort of hearing you know, any agency in the UK being that big, it's almost on par with you know, big American agencies, really. Could you just maybe talk a little bit about how do you do that? How did that actually happen? How did you grow from 150 people to 400 people?
Oh, simple, just do great work.
Okay.
Do great work.
And did you not find, I mean, that because, you know, within sort of 5 years of growing so much, I mean, I think from speaking to other people who've gone through huge amounts of growth periods and from my own personal experience, there are always moments in time where you're looking around and you're going, I don't know who's working here anymore. Were there any moments where you were kind of thinking, oh my God, you know, we've got to get back onto this culture. We've got to start investing in people because, you know, this agency is just growing beyond belief and we just don't know how to sort of control it. Were there ever moments like that?
No, I mean, you get to, yeah, we're busy and I think because we're obviously doing a good job, we get to do more work. So, I mean, I think the hardest thing is recruitment at the moment. It's just trying to just get the best people in we can. I think we've employed most of Manchester now, so I've got to start thinking. So we now got, I think I've got an Irishman from Singapore. He's going to be joining us in May.
Wow.
We've got another guy from Johannesburg's coming over. So we're starting to bring in people from wherever. So yeah, if anybody's listening to this, drop me a line.
Yeah.
We're looking for
plug away, because you know, recruitment's always a challenge and finding good talent is always hard, isn't it? So
yeah
plug away.
But another tricky thing is we do have I'll be doing an agency tour with a client, and I'm there trying to remember some of the names of the people. But I have a tactic for that now. I let them introduce themselves.
That's a good tip. As long as you don't forget the client's name, you're all right.
Yeah. Well, being able to say it is quite a tricky one.
Yeah, exactly. Talk to us a little bit then about how you got to win Agency of the Year at Cannes last year.
David obviously brought me in for reasons, obviously, to bolster and lead the creative department and obviously be as successful as we can. So cut to 4 years ago when I had my first away day management meeting. I think we were in the Lake District somewhere. And I basically I was introduced to all the senior management. There's probably about 30 or 40 people there.
Wow, not many.
Of the senior management. And then, and like I said, you know, each, because we, you know, back then we were probably about six agencies, five agencies, and it's all the team that runs those agencies.
Yeah.
So, and I had to sort of put forward my blueprint and mission and vision for what we were going to do creatively. So I was sort of standing at the front, a little bit nervous, and doing my presentation. And I was wearing a beige safari jacket and a pith helmet.
Right.
And obviously pith helmet's one of those, like, you know, from a, like a safari helmet sort of thing.
Yeah.
I'm looking a bit awkward and everybody's looking at me going, what the hell is this guy talking about? And obviously I revealed my vision, and my vision was to become healthcare agency of the year at Cannes by 2020.
Wow. Yeah.
So, and then I pulled out a Nerf gun and I shot one of our planning directors who had a massive beard and looked a bit like a lion.
Yeah.
It got even more awkward and people were looking at me going, who is this guy?
Yeah.
Who is this new creative leader we've hired?
That's really cool. So you shot him with a Nerf gun?
Yeah, I've got a shot of it somewhere. It's embarrassing. And I'm actually, I And then I actually took the hat out of me to Cannes this year, just in case. And I've got on the night. I was going to wear it on stage, but Dave was like, "Tom, do not wear that hat on stage." So I listened to it. But I did wear it for the rest of the night until the early hours of the morning.
Well, that's really cool. And what do you want to just maybe talk about the pieces that clinched it for you?
Yeah, so obviously I think what we'd been out to Cannes for the last couple of, well, obviously I think it was the second year I'd been the last couple of years, and I'd been sort of absorbing what was going on. Mm. And we're also noticing that a lot of work was going off in obviously the health and wellness rather than pharma. Mm. And a lot of agencies were sort of putting a lot of effort into that, and obviously we all know that every agency can enter health and wellness. So, you know, the competition was going to be, you know, you're going to literally have every agency in the world at it. So we just started thinking, right, well, let's just do what we do. We, you know, we work in the world of pharma. Let's not be embarrassed by it. And also, you know, we have budgets. Let's start educating our account guys and get them to work with us, and also our clients. And instead of doing, you know, getting an idea bought and getting it off the desk straight away and with stock shots, let's put some time in. Let's put some time to apply craft. Mm. Let's bring in some typography and CG and writing, and obviously use our budgets well. So that was kind of the mission we'd had probably for a year and a half before last year, of just like I said, applying craft, just getting the work bang on. And that's kind of what happened this year. So obviously we picked up quite a lot of awards for craft. So the AstraZeneca, the attack, was a great example of that. So just a beautifully crafted film, you know, just effortless. But even with that, there's a story behind every piece of work. Like that original brief was to just do a quick patient film. Could you do a patient interview? Mm. And that's what the client wanted. And
like a talking head sort of thing.
Yeah, it was a talking head thing. So we were like, and it was kind of, it'd kind of been written, so it was written, and then we went, I tell you what, you know, let's do something better. And Tim Jones was working for us then, and obviously we had a good chat, and Tim went off and wrote a much, much better script.
Yeah.
And obviously we then went back to the client, went, look, client, this is what you've asked for, but this is way better. And and luckily our client, who, he could see it, he could see the script, but there's another story behind that. His dad was actually a filmmaker.
Oh, right.
So he could see the script. He visualized it, which is very rare for you know, the way of our clients. So they're normally, you know, they go through the usual, don't they? They become sales reps in the marketing department. Yeah. So they're not really that visual. But luckily, he was.
Yeah.
So and then obviously the rest is history. So that was a bronze, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And then other pieces of work. So we had our Roche Actemra piece of work that was for Ouchy, which again, that brief client just wanted a support pack to go with the treatment. So again, we did that, and you know, instead of doing the usual treatment, we came up with a whole cartoon illustration idea. But then the more we chatted with patients, the more we realized there was an issue we could help solve, and that was obviously kids who are struggling with pain and in class really don't want to talk up in front of their classmates. So again, just the insight was, right, let's give them a support band that's, you know, costs literally nothing, that goes with the pack, so they can help to, you know, if they're in pain, they turn the white band over and they show the red side, and the teacher immediately knows what's going on.
That's great. That's really cool. I mean, I think when I saw that, I was like, that's really smart. That's a really sweet little idea. And it can be easy rolled out globally, right? It's
Absolutely. And you know, for me, that's, I love ideas like that. I love ideas that, you know, even though I'm an art director and I love my craft, I love ideas you can just tell somebody just very quickly in a sentence. And it's not about the art direction you're looking for, but it's just about a really new, interesting take.
Yeah, and it's almost anti-advertising, isn't it? It's not really it's not an ad, is it? Yeah. It's a solution to a problem, and that solution could be anything. I think that's where it gets really exciting within our industry, because the best things It's an idea to solve a problem. And I think the best, I don't know, from my perspective anyway, and just hearing you speak, the best things that make people a bit of a shudder and make people go, oh, fuck, that's amazing, are the sort of things that actually aren't advertising. They're sort of anti-advertising in a way, like that wristband.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what have we got to look forward to this year? Are you guys gonna attempt to hold on to that, to the best agency this year?
I think it's going to be hard, isn't it? Because it'll be hard, but yeah, we've got some interesting pieces of work kicking around. So, but yeah, never say die. You know what I mean?
No, I know. No, that's cool.
He says twitching a bit, but again, like I said, last year, you know, we were not expecting to win. You know, I think the year before we'd got two finalists.
Yeah.
And for me, I just wanted to come back with one line. I'd have been happy last year.
Yeah. Well, we'll still bring your Nerf gun out there, because even if you don't win anything, you can shoot whoever goes up on stage anyway. So you could do that. I mean, have you got any sort of tips for any creatives out there who are sat maybe listening to this thinking, you know what, I really want to be the next Tom Richards. You know, I want to go out there. I want to make a name for myself. I want to, you know, change people's lives that work for me. I want to do some great work. Have you got any tips for them?
Just never give up. Just, I mean, it's something you've got to learn as your sort of personality sort of develops. I think as a young creative, I was probably a bit of a knobber. I'd shout at account handlers. I might have made them cry occasionally, which is not good.
Yeah.
And then I think the more I've learned is the more I know my client, the more I know my account people, the more we work together, the better opportunity there is of getting work out.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, like, it's that empathy word again. You've got to understand what other people go through. Like account handlers, you know, it's got to be, what a horrible job. I never want to be an account handler.
Mm.
You know, just on call 24/7, being moaned at by the clients, you come back to the agency, you get moaned at by the creators. It's not easy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that'd be a big one. So the more trust you can create within your own agency and with your clients, the more you're going to buy, you get your work. So, like, if you're never going to get the most amazing award-winning piece of work through a client when you first started working with them.
Yeah.
Because they're just going to go, you don't get us. But over the, you know, you do your first piece of work, you do a good piece of work, and the trust happens. And then you start spotting opportunities within that account. You then start your relationship. You have an opportunity to show the clients great work. Don't show them farmer work. Show them work that's going on elsewhere.
Mm. Yeah.
And using technology, whatever. And then, you know, that trust happens. And then as soon as your clients start trusting you, they start buying the work.
Yeah. That's great. I think, yeah, resilience and trust. I think that's what I got from that. And I think, I think that's very true. Very true.
Yeah. I mean, there's another thing as well. Like whenever you've come up with your best idea, you go, oh, I've done it. I've got the best idea. You're high-fiving. You've gone for a pint.
Yeah.
This is DNAD. This is me. We're going to be a creator because of this idea.
Yeah.
And then you present it to the client and they kill it.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh. Like the old me would have sulked for a week.
Yeah.
But then that's really stood me well is that when your best idea has been killed, you will come up with a better idea.
Yeah.
You know, don't throw the idea away that's been killed. Just pop it in your bottom drawer.
Yeah.
Because one day it will come back out again.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. What were your best mistakes?
I've made quite a few through art direction and stuff. I did a shoot many, many years ago when we shot on film. I worked with a guy called John Parker, famous London photographer, and did a great job, and I was really chuffed. And we had a few beers afterwards, and then I had to rush for the train back to Edinburgh, so I jumped on the train. And I think probably because I'd had a few beers, I fell asleep. And when we turned up in Edinburgh, I jumped off the train really quickly, grabbed my bags and just got off the platform in time. And then I stood there and went, oh no. My trannies were on the train.
Going back.
and off they went to Aberdeen.
Oh god.
Obviously to those younger people out there, trannies are not transvestites. Yeah. Just to clarify that, I wasn't travelling with a load of trannies.
I'll edit that out, so I think it's transvestite, so don't worry.
I literally spent the whole weekend just absolutely papping myself. I think it was a £15,000 job.
Oh my god.
Because I got the original transparencies. Oh. That was the whole shoot.
Yeah. Did you get them back?
They turned up in Aberdeen and I had to drive up there. It took me 2 hours to get there and 2 hours to drive back.
Bloody hell, God. But interestingly, you know, you were talking about how you've sort of ran some courses for people to cope with different aspects of fear, right? At Havas Links. And I think fear generally comes over us because we're afraid of making mistakes. And I think it's only when you really overcome that fear of actually, you know what, it's okay to make a mistake. You know, we're all human and sometimes you have to make mistakes to learn because no one's born perfect. You know, everyone's born different, and you know, if we were all perfect, it would, you know, make life would be really boring, right? So I think the things that you've been doing at Havas Links have really inspired me, because I think we don't as an industry talk about that enough. You know, fear is within all of us, you know, whether it's fear of a pitch or fear of an internal meeting or fear of presenting your ideas or all of those things. And actually to not get it right first time is okay, and making mistakes is all part of making us better. So you know, even if that means leaving your photo shoot on a train going to Edinburgh, you know. it's all really good.
On the point of fear, obviously, you know, fear can be positive as well. You know, you can turn those, you can take those butterflies and those nerves, and if you can sort of contain them and harness them and point them into the right direction, you know, you can turn those butterflies and like turn them into dragons, sort of thing.
Yeah,
and they can have a really positive energy.
Yeah. That's great, turning butterflies into dragons.
Yeah, I should have said that in a Welsh accent, shouldn't I? What? Turning butterflies into dragons!
Well, you know, Game of Thrones is about to start as well, and you're from the north, so that's all quite good. It's all sort of, it's a good way, I think. So Tom, there's music, which means our time is at an end. I just want to take this opportunity to thank you for taking the time out. I think you're going to inspire a lot of people out there listening to this podcast. Yeah, thank you so much.
Brilliant, thank you.
Cheers. And for everyone else listening to this, if you like this podcast, please do rate us and subscribe. And until the next time, take care.